What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today we have a follow-up episode to last week. Last week we talked about a study that was looking at energy expenditure across the economic spectrum. So basically, as populations become more developed, how many calories do they burn through exercise? And spoiler, you know, it looks like even though people move less in more developed nations, they don't actually seem to burn fewer calories. So it kind of throws a wrench in this discussion of like, well, I thought moving more was good for me, but it doesn't seem that moving more makes me burn that many more calories. So should I even do it? Well, today we have a really nice follow-up because we have another study, again, came out this month, and the study is titled Daily Steps and Health Outcomes in Adults, a Systematic Review and Dose Response Meta-Analysis. Essentially, they aggregated studies that looked at, hey, as people get more steps, what sort of health improvements do we see? And we'll kind of go through this study in isolation. We'll talk about where intensive cardio comes into the mix here. And we'll try and just combine all of this into a more general, broad discussion of how much should we be moving if we don't want to die, right? So again, this study is titled Daily Steps and Health Outcomes in Adults, a Systematic Review and Dose Response Meta-Analysis. Meta-analysis just means it's a study of studies. So instead of it being its own study, it's aggregating research that's already been done that meets certain criteria. And then, you know, breaking that down and giving you kind of one large study of all of those studies combined. This study was meta-analyzed 57 studies across 35 cohorts, including data from over 160,000 adults. So they were able to look at a lot of people. And they looked at links between step counts and multiple health outcomes, including mortality, cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, depression, physical function, and falls. And let's talk about some of the main results here. The lowest step count that was analyzed here was 2,000. And from 2,000 steps, so starting with people who get 2,000 steps, as you got more steps, as people got more steps, everything gets better, right? All of those things I just listed, health outcomes, they get better, right? And so if you're imagining a graph from left to right, as people get more steps and we move from left to right, all of the bad stuff goes down. So rates of mortality, rates of cardiovascular disease, rates of cancer, diabetes, dementia, as people get more steps starting from 2000, all of those things go down. And that's good. We want rates of all of those bad things to go down. Around 7,000 steps per day, many of those things that I listed, cancer, diabetes, dementia, we'll talk about them in specifics in just a second. Many of them started to plateau. So around 7,000, actually around 5,000 to 7,000 steps per day, many of those benefits actually started to plateau. Let's do a couple of stats and then we'll dive in deeper. Getting 7,000 steps per day versus 2,000 steps per day showed a 47% lower risk of all-cause mortality. Essentially, you were 50% less likely to die. 25% less lower cardiovascular disease incidence, up to 37% lower cancer risk, 14% lower diabetes risk, 38% lower dementia risk, 22% lower depressive symptoms, and 28% lower risk of falls. So going from 2,000 steps per day up to 7,000 steps per day, amazing, huge, massive, monumental health outcome benefits. Now, for things like all-cause mortality, cardiovascular disease, dementia, and falls, the benefits increased, you know, rapidly from 2,000, but between 5,000 and 7,000, they plateaued. And so we started to see, hey, around 7,000 steps, getting more and more and more and more steps didn't meaningfully improve people's chances of dying or getting cardiovascular disease or dementia or falling, etc. However, for things like cancer, diabetes, and depression, the relationship between steps and those outcomes was more linear, meaning the more steps you got, the more benefit you got, up to around 12,000 steps per day. So my main takeaways from this study is that being sedentary, you know, 2,000 steps per day, really bad. And from that point, from like the first one is that being sedentary, let's say roughly 2,000 steps per day, is really bad. And from that point, every 1,000 steps is incredibly meaningful. Like I'm thinking of just from a client perspective, if somebody were to come to me, they're getting 2,000 steps per day. One might scoff at the idea of going from 3,000 steps per day to 5,000 steps per day, but it seems that that's actually a huge, huge, huge benefit for a lot of different things, basically all of these outcomes. And so if you are that person or you're a coach who works with this population, that don't scoff at that. Going from 2,000 or 3,000 steps per day up to, you know, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 steps per day is a huge, huge benefit. The second main takeaway is that 7,000 steps per day, you know, again, we see a lot of the benefits start to plateau around that point. And 7,000 is super manageable for most people. And in my opinion, should be seen as the target from a public health perspective, right? It's hard to put like a perfect number. Oh, it's exactly 7,000. But I think we have kind of glorified this idea of 10,000 steps per day when the data is saying, well, around 7 is where you're getting the bulk of the benefit. And so for people out there who are struggling to get more steps, this should be seen as just a nice win. Anytime we can kind of lower the bar for certain health outcomes, we will encourage people who might not be taking action because 10,000 feels like a lot, so why do anything, to say, you know what, maybe I can get 7. Another take home is that, hey, listen, that while that's true, overall, we do see better outcomes up to 12,000, right? So if you can do more, do more. It still makes sense, right? We see things like cancer, diabetes, and depression. They keep getting better up to 12,000 steps. And even other outcomes like mortality and heart disease and dementia. The only one that doesn't get better is falls. But my guess is that's because if you're getting more steps, you have a higher chance of falling, right? You'd have, if you just got 0 steps, you'd have no chance of falling unless you fell out of bed. So I think falls actually got worse after about 7,000. But I think that's just because people are moving more with more chance to fall. But everything technically did get better above 7,000. It's just that a lot of the benefits plateaued, right? And so maybe after you're getting, you know, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 steps per day, instead of thinking about getting more and more and more and more steps, maybe switch your focus to improving fitness instead of kind of spamming more and more and more leisurely walks, which again is amazing for your health. I don't want to poo-poo it as if there's not any more benefit. There absolutely is. But it might be the case that, you know, if you're in that 7,000 to 10,000 range and you have time for more movement instead of more steps, maybe think of adding some sort of higher intensity cardio. And we'll talk about why I have that recommendation in a second. I think a good analogy here is like protein intake. Just a lot of people listening to this podcast have probably heard something like, hey, you know, after 0.6 to 0.7 grams per pound of protein, the benefits really start to level off. Like, we're not even sure if there are more benefits above that number. And I think that that's something similar to what this data is pointing to. It says on a population level, once you're in and around 7,000 steps, a lot of the benefits start to plateau. But if you take the same question from an individual level, you know, there are some individuals who benefit from higher protein levels, just like there are going to be people. Well, I'd say this is a little bit different where everybody's going to benefit from more than 7,000 steps. It's just that some of those benefits plateau. There's a section I've titled, "But the Other Study Said," and I'll do a brief recap, but I, you know, in order to fully understand, have the whole top to bottom information, I would go listen to the previous week's podcast. I'll leave that in the description. But last week we looked at a study that looked at populations across the economic spectrum. So less developed nations up to more developed nations. So people who live more like a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, people who are farming, people who are foraging, all the way up to, you know, us in our cushy office jobs with Uber Eats. And they looked at how many calories people are burning through activity. And the assumption was that, hey, people in less developed nations, they tend to move more just because of the lifestyle demands. And people in more developed nations tend to move less. And that would show in the energy expenditure data. We would have people like hunter-gatherers burning way more calories, and would have John in an office job burning way less calories. And that is not what we saw. We saw that once we match for things like age, sex, and body size, across the globe, people burn basically the same amount of calories from activity. Now, I would not have this be my take home, but you could say, well, then moving more just doesn't matter. Because even if I move more, you know, we fall under some certain energy constraints and energy compensation that I'm not actually going to burn that many more calories. So why would I bother to burn more? And again, if this idea of energy compensation is completely new to you, I would go back and listen to last week's episode where I gave just a short breakdown. I think I'm going to do a more thorough breakdown in the future, but you know, how energy compensation works, why it happens evolutionarily, why it's kind of imperative to us surviving. And so I would go back and listen to that. But that study only looked at obesity and calories burned. And obesity, having excess body fat, specifically visceral fat, is going to increase your risk for all this other stuff, mortality, heart disease, dementia, diabetes, all that stuff, cancer. But there's more to metabolic health than just body fat. So that study was saying basically, hey, moving more doesn't necessarily lead to people weighing less because it doesn't necessarily lead to an increase in energy expenditure. However, in this study, it seems that moving more led to better health outcomes. So there must be some disconnect between burning more calories and having good health outcomes. And I would 100% agree that there is. Movement, moving your body, exercising, improving your fitness, it has positive health effects that are independent on calories burned and changes in body fat, right? Like moving your body, going for a walk, lifting weights, doing cardio has a independent benefit outside of just, you know, it burns calories and might help you lose weight, right? And of course, I think we have plenty of research now that confirms that exercise-only interventions aren't amazing at having people lose weight. And that's just like, you know, something we've known for a long time. So that study didn't say that moving more, the previous study didn't say that moving more doesn't improve health. What it did say, and again, I would go back and listen to the episode, is that when we look at the calories outside of the equation, so the energy expenditure side, the energy inside of it explains way more about obesity rates across the globe than how many calories we burn, right? It you can say that people in developed nations move less, but the data is showing that we don't burn less calories. We just eat too many calories. And so I think these two studies work well together because on one hand, you can see this paper that says, hey, moving more doesn't actually change obesity rates because it doesn't actually lead to extra calories burned. But then we have this paper that says, okay, hold up, moving more actually leads to improvements in health outcomes, apparently irrespective of changes in body fat level and energy expenditure. So I think these studies do work together quite a bit. And if you combine them from a public health perspective, right, not necessarily from an individual perspective, but from a public health initiative, we're trying to improve the health of our nation, you could deduce from these two papers that what we need to do is we need to get people to do at least 7,000 steps per day and eat less calories from ultra-processed foods. And I think everybody's just nodding along with that. And I think our current recommendations, by the way, like I say that as if that's a novel thing. That's not a novel thing. Like that, our current government guidelines are set up for that to happen, right? The current government guidelines say 150 minutes of low to moderate cardio, eat a calorie-controlled diet, mostly minimally processed foods. And so it's not like what I'm saying is super novel and all of a sudden going to change the game. But I think if we had to put our efforts, if we had to kind of think about how we're going to distribute our limited resources from a public health perspective, the vast majority of it should be towards eating less calories from ultra-processed foods. And then also over here from a movement perspective is maybe encouraging people, maybe we start to put this 7,000 step marker up on a bit more of a pedestal, because I think 10,000 really can be a lot for people. And if you can get to at least 7, it seems like you can get a high degree of the benefits. Now, what about this conversation of steps versus cardio, right? Like, what about cardio fitness? Are we just talking about steps and get more steps and get more steps? But what about more intense cardio that's going to, in a more robust way, improve cardiovascular fitness? What research do we have on, as people get more fit, do they die less? Do they get less disease, et cetera? So we have a really good paper from 2018 by Mansager, basically exploring how cardio fitness correlates with long-term all-cause mortality, right? So the fitter people are, how much do people die? That's basically what we're looking at here. And from an outcome perspective, it doesn't get any more blunt than that. It's like the fitter people are, the less they die. But by how much? And so all in all, this study showed that the higher your fitness level, your higher level of cardio fitness, and again, they did this by measuring it via a treadmill test, which I won't go over here, but basically like a graded ramp test where every 3 minutes it gets harder. And then at some point you say uncle and you get off, right? And when you get off, it correlates with a certain, let's say a certain metric. And then we stratify people and put them into, on a graph and just see, okay, how many people died in the lower quartile and the below average and the elite and the good, all that stuff. And so what they found was the higher your fitness level, the less people died. And they like, no shit, but there was no plateau and there was no what we would call like an upside down U. And what that means is it didn't seem like there was a plateau. It didn't seem like, hey, as you get really, really fit, it doesn't seem to be any more beneficial. It just seemed like as you get more fit, you see better outcomes, which is pretty cool, especially considering we just talked a lot about diminishing returns with more steps. It doesn't seem like there's a huge plateau with cardiorespiratory fitness. And so again, once you're at that like 7 to 10,000 step range, maybe you start plugging some more cardio and you get in better shape. And so just to drop some numbers, the elite group, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what being elite in terms of cardiorespiratory fitness means, but the elite group versus the low group, so the people that were in the best shape versus the worst shape, being in the best shape meant having an 80% lower mortality risk than being in the least good shape, right? The low group had a 5 times, right? Again, I'm just saying the same thing in different ways. Being in the low group versus the elite group had a hazard ratio of about five, we'll say. So being in the lowest fitness category, you had 5 times greater risk of dying than being in the elite category. And I just want to put that number in perspective. And again, I'll tell you what elite means because, you know, of course, when we are looking at the extremes, it's going to sound extreme, but I'll touch on that in a second. But just to put some things in context, being in the low group compared to being in the elite group, you had a 5 times or a hazard ratio of 5. Compared to things like smoking, so if you smoke, if we test smokers versus non-smokers, smoking has a hazard ratio of 1.4, which means you have a 40% increased chance of dying. Say. Being in the low fitness category compared to the elite, you had a 500% increased chance of dying. I'm not diminishing the power of the negative power of smoking. It's serious shit. You should not smoke. But being in the lowest fitness quintile here, versus being in the most fit group, is, you know, I'll do some simple math here. I won't do any simple math. You know, is 8 times more, has an 8 times worse outcome. And I just want to put that in perspective again. I just think that, let's just sit with that for a second. Like, again, being, you know, diabetes has a hazard ratio of 1.4 also. So diabetics versus non-diabetics, you have a 40% greater chance of dying. Being in the low fit group versus the elite fit group, you have a 500% chance of dying. So 5 times greater risk. And so I was interested in what it meant to be in the low fit category and what it meant to be in the elite fit category. And so obviously had to go deeper into the paper just to see what they are considering elite. And so the low fit group would be maybe somebody who basically cannot jog a mile at all, right? They cannot at any pace jog a mile. They would have to walk the mile in 18 to 20 minutes or so. They would be unable to sustain something that resembles jogging for any meaningful amount of time. That is the lowest fit category. The elite fit category is an ability to run a mile between 6 and 7:30. The younger you are, the closer to 6 minute mile. The older you are, the closer to 7:30. And that's no joke. That is fast. I would say, without being annoying, if you're a runner, I bet you don't think that that's super fast. But like when we're talking about like being fit enough to just not die, yeah, that's pretty fast. The high fit group would be running a mile in like 8 to 9.5 minutes, which I think is super doable for people who want to pursue the upper bounds of health. Above average was more like a 10 to 12 minute mile. Below average was like a 13 to 15 mile. And then the low fit group was, you know, basically unable to run or jog a mile, you know, requirement to walk in 18 to 20 minutes. So let's put all this together. I know that was a little bit all over the place, but we have three things going on here. We have one study that says the more you move, it doesn't really affect energy expenditure that much because of energy compensation. So it doesn't really impact rates of obesity that much. Then we have another study that says, okay, but the more you move, the better health outcomes you see. We see a risk reduction across the board, you know, with some of those things plateauing around 5 to 7,000, with others not plateauing and continuing up and up into around 12,000. And then we have other research, not just this paper, showing that when we're talking about cardiovascular fitness, so actual like ability to perform on things like a treadmill test, the fitter you are, the better the outcomes, with almost no plateau and certainly no downside. Truthfully, there are people who are in better shape than that elite category? What about people running 5-minute miles, 4-minute miles? Would we start to see an upside down U? Would we start to see a downside? Would we start to see a plateau? I don't know, but I don't really think that that's all that interesting, because I don't think that that there's a large enough percentage of the population that falls in there. I think that elite category is something people could do if they, that is a hard, fast mile, really fast. I'm not going to say that it's not, but I also don't think it's an insane feat of speed if you really trained for it, but whatever, for another day. So I think we have two studies that say getting in better shape and moving more is helpful. And then another study that says, yeah, but maybe it's not because you're burning all these extra calories. There must be some sort of independent benefit outside of increase in energy expenditure and decrease in obesity. So all in all, let's kind of package these together real quick. 7,000 steps feels like a good place to aim for Gen Pop, looking for a large percentage, but maybe not all of the positive effects of movement. From 7 to 12,000 steps per day, we still see a more benefit in certain things. I think it was cancer, dementia, depression. And that's super meaningful. So if you have time for more and you want more, right? Like I always say, if you have time and ambition for more, more will still help. I'd say steps isn't a proxy for cardio fitness, which itself independently has health benefits. And we have yet to see a plateau or, let's say, worse outcomes when improving cardiovascular fitness. On a population level, I think we should encourage people to aim for at least 7,000 steps per day. And then in my opinion, once you're in and around that ballpark, I might shift my attention to improving cardio fitness with more, let's say, direct intense cardio. And I'm not saying it's got to be high intensity interval training classes or any of that. I just mean something more challenging than a walk in the park, right? And again, to individuals, yeah, there are more benefits with more steps and more fitness, but let's get the population to 7,000 steps of activity. When it comes to obesity, it seems that moving more is not anywhere near as meaningful as initiatives that would get people to eat less calories from ultra-processed foods. So it's not that moving more doesn't matter at all. Clearly, moving more improves health outcomes. But from an obesity perspective and on a population level and a public health initiative perspective, it seems that getting people to eat less calories from ultra-processed foods is a way bigger contributor. So I know we're a little bit all over the place there, but it's just an interesting triangulation of the idea of moving more doesn't burn more calories, but moving more does lead to better health outcomes, and getting more fit leads to dying less. We have that triangulation in this, you know, that we bring it all together and say, hey, moving more definitely helps. 7,000, we start to see some things plateau. Things tend to get better even beyond there, though. But from a public health perspective, let's put more of our effort into getting people to eat less calories from ultra-processed foods. And if I'm going to be a little bit cheeky here, get people to eat less calories from ultra-processed foods, not, you know, fucking tinker with individual ingredients in ultra-processed foods that will have absolutely no impact on public health. All right. And with that, I say see you in the next one.